It wasn't so long ago that we visited with the author of a biography of Robert Ripley, the creator of the long, long-running newspaper cartoon Ripley's Believe It or Not. Today's guest works in a similar vein, just with word stories instead of pictures. Nick Bilardis collected a whole lot of unusual tales, true ones, in his book, A People's History of the Peculiar, a freak show of facts, random obsessions, and astounding truths. Nick Bilardis is a historian, but blogged his way to national attention. Now his articles and essays appear in places like CNN.com and other news sites. He is the founder of Face News, runs a nonfiction writing group, and is the author of the first original literary novel on Twitter called Small Places. He also writes poetry and creates illustrations for other books. He lives in Bakersfield. Nick Bilardis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show. Your walk this morning that you were just talking about sounded pretty pleasant.
It was. Nothing like getting a little fresh air before you dive into the day's work. Caroline Levitt, in the foreword of your book, describes you and she as drawn to the bizarre. Is that a fair charge to you?
I think so. I've talked to Caroline a lot about this, and she's a wonderful novelist. She's written a few New York Times bestsellers, and I think writers are some of the strangest people I know as a novelist by trade too. That's mainly what I work on these days. And you know, she wrote in that foreword. I remember when I asked her to write it, and when I received it from her, and I started reading about her childhood. I thought, man, this is one weird lady, because she started talking about I think it was a book or a comic book or something, and she was reading about portals opening up. And so she started trying to make that happen. And, you know, kids will do anything. You know,
right.
Kids, you tell a kid that the Incredible Hulk is real, and they're going to go crazy trying to find him in their neighborhood. But still, I think writers, there's something strange about us and how we use our imagination.
That is actually what makes you writers, isn't it?
I think so. You know, I think most writers who I've talked to, we've all developed our imagination at a very young age. I was reading novels, I think, when I was in second or third grade. My dad gave me an Edgar Rice Burroughs novel from the Pellucidar series called Back to the Stone Age, and that was the first novel I'd ever read, and I was really, really young, and I was instantly hooked because through novels, and it's kind of the same through history if you really study history. It's so different to read it than to talk about it, or to see an adaption from history or a novel on TV or in the movies or a documentary. It's much different if you're reading. It does something different to the brain. And if you're really turned on by that, then your imagination starts working, and maybe you can become a writer too. So,
tell us how a Mad Magazine map helped you down the road toward the bizarre, the kinds of things that are featured in A People's History of the Peculiar.
I don't know how many people remember Sergio Aragonés from Mad Magazine. And if anybody who's read Mad Magazine, and I mean, I was reading Mad Magazine back in the 70s when I was a kid, and he drew all those little cartoons in the margins. Well, how brilliant was Mad Magazine to create cartoons in the margins and have this artist drawing all these funny little cartoons? Well, that's what Sergio did.
And they called that marginal thinking too, didn't they?
Something like that. And one of his projects was to create a map of America. So it was a fold-up map that was in one of the editions of Mad Magazine. And in that fold-up map, you take it out, it's huge, and I put it on my bedroom wall, and he drew all kinds of little cartoons for the different places in America. And some of those places were mysterious and strange. I remember in San Jose, California, there was this freeway that never could get built. It was always part of the Clover. And he was smart. He took that part of the Clover that was never made, and he put that on the map to symbolize San Jose, which was kind of mysterious. Like, why is this freeway never getting built? So that really affected me, because I loved maps. Maps of amusement parks, maps of that Sergio Aragonés made. And I really think that that maps are sort of a doorway to knowledge, because especially today, you could look at a map and look at Google Maps. You could explore down to individual neighborhoods. You can go to street views. I can't even imagine having a Google map as a kid. I had Sergio Aragonés map.
Yeah, which was plenty good. I remember the National Lampoon map of the world, too, where the capital of the Philippines was listed as Huck Pitui.
Yeah.
Great stuff like that. You got to make some of your own maps, too, though. You actually did copy the Sergio Aragonés style, didn't you?
Yeah, I was an art major for a while, and then I was a history major, and that being that art major for a few years and opening that part of my brain, that part of me has never gone away. I still love to doodle, and so when I connected with Jonathan Evason, who's from the Pacific Northwest, and he wrote a novel called West of Here, and he needed some crazy map drawings, some pen and inks done for his novel. At first, I was a little hesitant because he was a friend, and I didn't necessarily want to do it just because I was his friend. But then, you know, things worked out, and that book became a New York Times bestseller, and I'm super honored to have drawn fun little maps of the mountain ranges and exploration.
I'll ask you in just a few moments about why this was not an illustrated book with your art background. We'll get into that when we get after this break. Nick Bilardis is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's talking about his book, A People's History of the Peculiar, a freak show of facts, random obsessions, and astounding truths. We'll talk more with Nick and take your phone calls and emails about some astounding facts, figures, and truths you might know when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the novelist and historian and illustrator Nick Bilardis. His latest book is called A People's History of the Peculiar, a freak show of facts, random obsessions, and astounding truths. All kinds of wacky facts and figures throughout history, strange creatures that once inhabited the earth and some that still do, stuff like that. You can join us on the exchange with stories of your own or things you might have heard about the things you'll be hearing up ahead. 800-838-3760, the number to call anywhere in the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So the question then, Nick, about since you do have an art background, you were an art major for a while before you switched to a history major. You've drawn stuff for other people's books. Why not do a more of a Ripley's Believe It or Not kind of treatment for A People's History of the Peculiar?
No, that's a very interesting question. Well, for one, I wasn't asked to.
Oh.
but I suppose, you know, that's something that I could... I think about that a lot with my novels because... And I haven't actually thought about that. That's actually... So you just sparked a great idea. I mean, kudos to you for that idea with the history and strange pictures. I'd actually been thinking about that for a novel because there's something that's been happening in the industry, the publishing industry, the last few years where if you go to a bookstore, you just see it more and more. You see pictures and novels. And that's the way it used to be. You used to get a lot of drawings and novels, and then it just stopped for many decades. You would rarely see any kind of illustrations in a novel. So it's something I think about. I think the main reason I don't do it too right now is it's just time consuming. It's easier for me to write a few pages than it is to spend several hours on a drawing.
Well, and obviously when you're undertaking a project like this too, I mean, you probably would have broken your arm trying to do drawings for all the things in this book, or even a fraction of them. There's a lot of stuff in here, and there are obviously so many odd things to look at in history. How do you start such a process?
Well, there were some topics from when I went to graduate school that I was interested in, and I kind of started there to brainstorm for categories, because not all the categories are history in this book. There's weird science and strange literary stuff and weird inventions and mysterious places. But for history, it started, I think, when I was in graduate school, and one of the items in the book talks about disease as being a cultural determinant for history. And what that means is that a lot of people, a lot of historians, it's more common today, but a lot of historians didn't think in terms of that epidemics could, for instance, cause a group of people to make certain decisions that affected the history of our nation. So one of the things I looked at is the waves of yellow fever in Philadelphia in the 1790s. And when I was a graduate student, I was really interested in that and how those waves of epidemics possibly coerced our nation's founders to create a capital in Washington, D.C. instead of Philadelphia. So that was one of the starting points I had for the history section. And the rest of it was, I'm one of those library lurkers who maybe some people think that archives and libraries are these deep, dark, dusty places, but they're usually the historical archives are the books that the students all pass by and never open. And so that's where I kind of came in, and I just started exploring, and I started writing down some things that were interesting to me.
So let me get it straight. So you're suggesting that Philadelphia might have stayed the national capital. In fact, there was, you point out, there was land set aside for a federal district like what became the District of Columbia. But because of yellow fever that people got all scared of Philadelphia?
Well, there were some huge epidemics of yellow fever. We're talking about a disease that would kill thousands of people. And I'm guessing, I don't remember the exact numbers of the population of Philadelphia in the 1790s, but for some reason the numbers in around 40,000 come to mind. It wasn't what we think of Philadelphia today or any kind of metropolis in the eastern seaboard. And we're talking when thousands of people die and people don't know what's even causing it. They didn't even know what was causing this yellow fever. They had all kinds of strange theories at the time. And Philadelphia was one of the most enlightened cities in the world, not just North America, but the world. And here was the early republic. This is where the government was meeting. So when these epidemics came and people were skedaddling from town, including the government that was meeting there, well, I think it started to leave a bad taste in people's mouths. They started to think, well, why do we want to have our government here? So many people are dying. Do we want to deal with this every single year? And so I think a movement began to build a federal city someplace else.
Well, you know, and you talk about other ways in which history turned on diseases, or in this case, a hemorrhoid. Who owned the hemorrhoid that might have changed the history of Europe?
Well, and that was another interesting book that another book I'd read in graduate school that was called, I think it was called Napoleon's Plan. And it was, and I think the author was Arno Carlin. I could be wrong. Look it up. Google it, everybody. And he wrote what was considered psychohistory. And I remember my professors didn't necessarily believe in psychohistory, although some of the books that we used had a psychological perspective. You know, if disease can be a cultural determinant, can the psychological makeup of Napoleon because of his stomach aches cause him to lose battles and be the end of him? So that's something to explore in the book too. And one of the great things about this book is that you get little tastes of things like Napoleon's glands, and then you can explore further. We were talking about maps and maps kind of being a gateway to knowledge. That's kind of the way this book is set up. You get little bits and pieces of history, but just enough that if you're really interested, you could go really dig in. I mean, you could dig super deep, and then you can have a water cooler conversation with your friends and say, "Well, I don't believe that a stomach ache could end the Napoleon's bid for global domination," or you might believe that, hey, maybe you're somebody who gets stomach aches too, and understand how debilitating stomach aches can be.
I'm looking at the title of the book you were just talking about, Napoleon's Glands and Other Ventures in Biohistory. Arno Carlin is indeed the author of that, so still available out there in the world. Napoleon's Glands, what a great book title, huh? So, all right, as long as we're in the disease area, let's talk about Thomas Jefferson and his grandson. Let's start with TJ first, because there are some things here that I don't think a lot of people know about Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, I think when we think of our presidents, there's a term used that is for ancestor worship. It's called filial pietism, and I think sometimes that still affects us today. That if somebody is a president of our country, we automatically put that person on a pedestal like a superhero, and we start to think that everything about that person is, you know, it's suddenly not human. They don't get sick. you know, nothing happens to them. Well, and especially somebody like Thomas Jefferson, you know, here's the guy who drafted the Declaration of Independence. So he's got to be a superhero, right? But here was a man who himself battled depression and battled anxiety, things that a lot of Americans battle today. He often found himself in fits of where he just couldn't create. And so he talks about that in some of his documents, and some of the historians have dug this stuff up. And so I suggest in the book that, okay, if Thomas Jefferson could fall into mental states, well, we know that a mental illness, when I'm not suggesting that he had mental illness, but if he did, then how does that pass down to his children and his children's children? And one of the stories that isn't talked about very much is that he had a grandson named Lilburn who had a violent side to him, and that some land was bought for him and so that he would move far away from the Thomas Jefferson, but that there's a story that he killed one of his slaves with an axe or just simply dropping a water pitcher. Now, whether that's a mental illness that caused Lilburn to do that, or just maybe he's just a horrible person, just was a horrible person, that's, again, could be a great water cooler conversation. I mean, think about our past presidents. Somebody was just telling me recently they were studying Abraham Lincoln taking, I forgot what he was taking, but it had mercury in it, and they were saying it was making him really sick. And you know, the history of medicine itself and how it affects our past leaders can be a really interesting discussion just by itself.
Oh, sure. And there have been movies made about it, The Madness of George III. Or the Madness of King George, as it was known in America. I guess they didn't call it that in America. I hear this because people would have thought they missed The Madness of George I and George II.
Yeah.
Nick Belardis is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A People's History of the Peculiar, a freak show of facts, random obsessions, and astounding truths. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange to throw some more stuff on the pile or ask some questions about the things you're hearing from Nick. Join us at 800-838-3760 around the region in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We got a message here from Mark in Reading. He had heard that the U.S. Capitol was moved to the District of Columbia so President Washington wouldn't have to free his slaves when he went there.
I don't think this topic, for one, has been explored enough, and I'm only offering one suggestion for it. History is very interesting because you could take any topic of history, and you could take 10 renowned historians tackling the same topic, and because of how they're utilizing historical evidence, they might come up with all kinds of different suggestions. But one of the letters that I had uncovered was from I don't have my book in front of me, and I want to say Alexander Hamilton, and I should know this by back of my hand, but if you pick up the book, you'll see exactly who it was. But one of our early leaders was infected with yellow fever and had wrote letters back and forth with George Washington. And that particular leader, influential person, was saying in his letter that, "Hey, I don't want to be in Philadelphia." So there's suggestions within the historical documents themselves that people were unhappy with Philadelphia. Now, of course, there can be all kinds of other reasons why the Capitol was moved. But I think that the sentiment at the time for Philadelphia as a city of enlightenment lost its steam to even bid for Philadelphia to be the center of the new nation. So when people lose their steam, then where's the fight? Where's the fight in making anything happen when the people aren't happy or when the people are missing from town because right. They've run away from a disease.
Right. Yeah, you're right. It was Hamilton. It's here on page 11 of your book that he and his wife fell ill in September of 1793. And there were some letters that exchanged between he and Washington. This is a whole chapter about a mast from the past that we're still dealing with here. But Christopher Columbus, I want to mention before we go away, because this is a guy who boy, over the last 50 years, what a change in his reputation from discovered America to what a nasty guy. But you're saying in this book, we really don't know that much about him.
We don't. And even since writing this book, this is probably shocking to hear. I start thinking more and more, do people still need to know who Christopher Columbus is anymore? And I know that's kind of shocking to hear, but we don't even know what he looks like. There are dozens of portraits for which he didn't sit for. So all these paintings and drawings of Christopher Columbus, he never sat for one. We don't know what he looks like. There are descriptions of him, but we don't actually know. A historian kind of stole what Winston Churchill once said and called Christopher Columbus a riddle wrapped inside a mystery, inside an enigma, because we don't know exactly where he was born. We don't know when he was born. We don't really know his family background. We don't know where he got his ideas for voyaging west. There's a really strange story that isn't even in my book that's called The Story of the Unknown Pilot, where this is a sailor who was possibly Andalusian sailing from Spain to England, caught in a massive storm that supposedly took his ship to some island of naked people. And that pilot was rumored to be a close friend of Columbus, and he fell ill, and Columbus took him into his home. And then the rumor is, in the rumor mills, this is the rumor mills from the time shortly after Columbus's death, I believe, and that suggesting that this pilot shared a secret navigational chart as he was dying with Christopher Columbus. So, I mean, this is, we don't know. And another interesting idea is that this ship's log of Christopher Columbus has been called the documentary link between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. And we think about that first ship's log where he supposedly discovers the New World and how important that document is to history. But yet the original document's lost, the copy of that document was lost, and the copy created by the Dominican friar who was a friend of the Columbus family, Bartolome de las Casas, we don't even know if he embellished a lot, because part of that ship's log is written in a third person. So there's all these mysteries surrounding Christopher Columbus. And even just last week, somebody wrote to me and said, Christopher Columbus is Polish. And they were convinced that Christopher Columbus is Polish. So we know that he's Genoese. You know, we can at least suggest that's where he came from. But Polish, come on. And not to mention what you were just talking about, the violence associated with Christopher Columbus and you know, expecting gold tributes, and if he didn't get them, you know, having people's hands cut off and, you know, those kinds of things. You know, there's a lot of heinous things related to this enigma of a man.
And it's still very much an enigma. Okay, let's move on to the chapter on unnatural sciences, and we'll start with Dunkelostius from way back in history. What was Dunkelostius?
Oh boy! You know, now you're catching me off guard.
This big fish, wasn't it?
Well, you know, in this book, you can find so many facts about strange animals, bizarre dinosaurs, things that you don't even think about, finding a giant claw in the desert that's the size of a surfboard. These things that we don't even think about, but that our scientists are discovering. The fossil smiles that you can find in the sides of cliff walls, for I forget which dinosaur that is, or the ones I mentioned on the prehistoric penguins that I talk about on the cover of the book.
These are huge penguins, weren't they?
Yes, and there's just so much that you can dive into in this book that, you know, I just, please pick up a copy. If anybody has questions, you can find me at nicholasbelardis.com about any questions about this particular book, all of its strange facts that sometimes I have to look things up myself. And I look at it and I say, oh my gosh, I wrote about Dunkelostius. Did I really write about that one? Because there's just so much in there.
Well, the Dunkleosteus was a 30-foot long fish. Paleontologists affectionately called them dunks, not teddy bears of the sea, as you point out, but they could crunch down with 22,000 pounds per square inch of pressure. And instead of teeth, they had plates. This sounds like a fierce thing, like the Loch Ness Monster, perhaps, of prehistoric times. We'll come back and talk more about the stuff that you can find in Nicholas Bilardis's book. It's called The People's History of the Peculiar. We'll come back and talk more about the book. Take your phone calls and emails as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Nick Bilardis, historian, writer, artist, and the author of the book A People's History of the Peculiar, a freak show of facts, random obsessions, and astounding truths. All kinds of fun things like Napoleon's hemorrhoid that might have caused him to make some different decisions and not terribly good ones at the Battle of Waterloo. Why Washington, D.C. became the U.S. capital instead of Philadelphia probably had a lot to do with yellow fever. Things like that. You can join us here on the Exchange if you have more facts you'd like to add or ask about the stuff that you've heard about here. 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. I just mentioned that Dunkleosteus was something like the Loch Ness Monster. And you do touch on the Loch Ness Monster in the book briefly. I mean, from what you were able to find out, was there ever anything that sort of matches the description of the Loch Ness Monster, even if not in Loch Ness in Scotland itself?
By the way, I just tweeted that the radio host just stumped me with one of the facts for my own book. Hashtag embarrassing. So
I'll go retweet that one.
Here's what's interesting about the book. And yeah, there were dinosaurs that looked like the Loch Ness Monster, and they found skeletal remains of these creatures that have lived in even in freshwater lake areas. So, that could definitely happen. I think one of the things that's interesting about history itself, and just to kind of change the subject a tiny bit, is that when we think about history, we don't often think about, well, if the historical record is what's sort of illuminated by the light of these written documents and the facts, there's also the majority of what isn't illuminated about our past. And it's that lack of record that sometimes we get little bits and pieces, and it could even be things that can be considered supernatural, not to say that the Loch Ness Monster is a supernatural creature, if it even exists. But there are bits and pieces of stories that can seem like they're supernatural. For instance, in the book we talk a lot about Mothman. And whether or not Mothman is real, there is just enough within the historical record now, which would be considered what people's eyewitness accounts, newspaper articles, credible newspaper articles about a supernatural creature. Well, do those items prove that the supernatural creature exists? No, but it's fascinating to be able to say that, hey, there are these parts about our past that are sort of supernatural, that are sort of the dark side of history, that we shouldn't just discount. For instance, talking about the Salem witchcraft trials, here was Tituba sitting on the stand and talking about flying on a broomstick or flying on a stick and talking dogs and being able to command birds to attack people. This stuff's very supernatural. In fact, if people are also interested in other urban legends, which I encourage people to write about your urban legends and to explore your areas, I'm really, really big on that. And where I am in Bakersfield, California, if you go to my website at nicholasbilardis.com, you'll see right on the homepage the biggest urban legend out of Bakersfield, which is about the Lords of Bakersfield. And it's something I've been exploring for around a decade now, and you can also pick up a novel I wrote, which really digs into the psychological perspective of that urban legend. whether it's real or not, I don't know. There's a lot of newspaper stories about the Lords of Bakersfield, so if you're really interested in corrupt town structures and ghost stories and things like that, check out that, too, because that is just as strange as this people's history of Peculiar and all the weird history that I tell in there.
Let's take a call. We have Jill in Talent on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Nick Belardis, the author of A People's History of the Peculiar.
Hello, Nick and Jeff. I heard something very peculiar, and a present-day animal, the great heron, when it sits up in the tree and it's being attacked by, say, an eagle, a large predator, it doesn't move. It waits until the attacker is almost upon it, and then lightningly turns its head, and the predator impales itself.
Really? Huh.
I know. That's what I said.
Okay. So it's like a last-second defense mechanism for a creature being attacked. Wow.
If you've never seen a heronry, which is where blue herons live, it is one of the most fascinating things you can see. I remember being in northeastern Ohio near Cuyahoga Falls and being driven down a road, and this man said, "Have you ever seen a heronry?" And I hadn't. And he showed me these large trees. I don't remember what kind they were. And they had, in every tree on this stretch, had maybe 10, 15 nests that were as big as your arms wide. I mean, they were giant nests, and so many in a tree. It was like looking at a fairy tale. I wouldn't mess with a great blue heron, and now I know not to.
All right. Jill, thanks for that story. Appreciate it. Let's see, other creatures that we talk about here. Lamprey control in the Great Lakes comes up as a subject matter in the book, and it's interesting to hear that they've been using hormones. What are the hormones supposed to do?
Well, our landscapes are filled with all kinds of parasites, and whether it's creatures or plants that are unwanted that come from far away. I think of here in Central California, foxtails, which came from Europe and the hides of cows, and here these lamprey are infesting lakes and rivers, and as a way to get rid of them, to use their own hormones to try to attract them away. To try to just, you know, think they're chasing their own kind, they might leap in that area if they think they're going to go mate. So I think that's where that comes from, is this idea that our landscape is filled with all kinds of unwanted pests, and we have to be very creative in dealing with them. Just like the famous case of myxomatosis with rabbits, and I believe it was in Australia. When rabbits were infesting, it's either in Australia or an island near that. I can't remember exactly, but once again, Google it, myxomatosis. You'll find out a very peculiar story about getting rid of rabbits by infecting them with a disease called myxomatosis, which was thought which was expected to eradicate the rabbits, but it would only kill like 99.9%. There's always that 1% of rabbits, 0.1% of rabbits that would survive, and then they do what? Breed like rabbits. And then, of course, they built immunities to this myxomatosis, and eventually myxomatosis didn't do anything, and there was still that rabbit problem.
Even the stuff that, I mean, obviously the stuff in the human part of history, and you go way back into natural history that predates humans, but humans have been brought up short by nature quite a few times over the years. Constantly, in fact.
Definitely. I think the prehistoric record kind of shows that mankind could have been very second to some very large, very mean creatures, and we're very lucky that the dinosaurs died out. Can you imagine having to deal with one of those in your neighborhood?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It seemed to be okay for Fred and Wilma, but I guess that really wasn't necessarily reality.
Dino was domesticated, okay.
Right. Plus, he had such a cute voice. oddly enough, we talked about some diseases already in history and the disease theory of history, and then you get back into them in Chapter 3 in the book about puzzling ailments, both modern and historic. There's one story in here that we mentioned in one of the promos coming up was Tree Man. Do you remember Tree Man's story?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if, you know, I put him in the book because because he was so odd, because he was so weird, and I don't know if, you know, the way the news is, you know, and I've worked in the news for a long time, is we'll talk about something that's fascinating, and then we don't. Suddenly nobody talks about, you know, these strange things. And here was a man who was, he was half tree, he seemed like he was half tree, half man. His name was Day-Day. He was a fisherman. And he had these branch-like brown growths shooting from, almost like his arms and legs were wide stumps. He looked like a tree. It looked like he had brown tree-like growths shooting from his feet. And you can find videos of him. You can find all kinds of news stories. And I just, you know, I knew this book would be around for a long time, and I just included him in here because he's just, you know, he's one of those anomalies that people should just go back and explore and see what happens to people. And at the same time, this poor man. And then at the same time, again, this poor man who, how brave he is for dealing with this disease. And I'm probably, after this radio show, I'm gonna Google him myself to see if there's been any more updates, any more news stories, because this has been a while since I've researched him. But he lived near Jakarta, and he was battling these wart-like growths that were covering his body. So that's really what he had was a form of human papillomavirus, and it just caused his body to go out of control.
Really? It's just HPV that led to that?
Yeah, and how strange. It makes you wonder if there are other people who have experienced the exact same thing, who just are so secretive, so hidden, that they just, we never see them because there's so many people who are infected with strange diseases that disfigure them, and they hide from people because they don't want to be seen.
Well, there's another example of a disease in here, though, that I'm just reading here now, that the researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been kind of stumped by Morgellons disease, which is a fairly modern affliction. But you mentioned it in the book, and can you describe what goes on here? There's sores, and there's a feeling of something under the skin.
And there's also something else going on with, because of the internet and how the internet works and how we connect to each other. There's this whole idea of, is Morgellons disease a form of hysteria between people who are paranoid to thinking they have it? And what they think they have are these microscopic fibers underneath the skin. They have bouts of itching and intense pain. And they claim to be able to pull out these fibers. They're found also in lesions. I think that's extremely odd. I always try to sort of put myself in somebody else's shoes, and I can only imagine, you know, you feeling like you have these fibers under your skin has to just be one of the most tormenting feelings that you could ever have. And whether it's real or not, at least it's been looked into, and there's enough people who are saying they have it. Let's hope something happens for some of these people, whatever it is.
I'm actually seeing it at the Mayo Clinic site, so you know, it's not that the medical science is not dealing with this. They're still rather stumped by what it all might add up to. There's a section in the book, in the chapter on puzzling ailments, about random remedies. It's a fairly long list, and there are several lists like this through the book, but one of them is a chocolate bar to ward off coughing. I'm going to guess you've tried that one a few times, Nick.
I haven't tried that one, and another, there's a lot, and obviously I haven't tried PMS bloating, and there's a lot of really weird ones on here. Sore throat, for sore throat, I list Manuka honey from New Zealand can kill over 250 bacterial strains and can help heal burns, too. But that's something that I think all of us try. We use different types of honey. You can even order killer bee honey. You know, you can order all kinds of honey and try it for different ailments. The stinky toes, soak your feet in 2 cups of hot tea diluted with extra water. As soon as somebody tells me I have stinky toes, I'm going to go try that. And there's a lot of lists in this book. And so please go pick up a copy, because there's just so much information in here. And especially with random remedies. A nosebleed, you know, sudden chills on the back of the neck can cause blood vessels to contract. So if you have like a cold key or an ice cube, you know, that could possibly stop a nosebleed. You know, these are things that, you know, we live in this age of internet once again, and with the age of internet comes homemade remedies, and you can just find them by the bucket load on the internet. And I wrote some of the, what I thought was some of the more interesting ones.
Well, in that case, is it kind of hard to write a book like A People's History of the Peculiar, because there are so many things that people could go out and do research themselves? I mean, essentially, you're using this as a starting point, it sounds like, to say, hey, go to Google if you want to find out more about this.
Yeah, and not just go to Google, but go to your library, especially with some of the history topics or some of the mysterious places. I mean, there's some really deep things in this book, and especially when it comes to stories about the founding fathers or something like the Salem witch trials. You can literally go read the witch trials yourself. You can read so many historical documents. And I like to talk about the internet now because there's so many books you can read for free on the internet these days. So a lot of times you don't even have to leave your home. You can explore history on the net. Wikipedia is even becoming much more scholarly. There was an article in the LA Times, I believe, yesterday just about that.
All kinds of fun stuff in the book, and a lot of starting points even for further research. It's called The People's History of the Peculiar, a freak show of facts, random obsessions, and astounding truths. Nick Belardis wrote it and joined us. Nick, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure.